This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Want to pay for parking, and neither does anybody else, but you don't want to pay for gasoline, and you don't want to pay for insurance. Parking is the big exception. It's very expensive, and we expect to get it for free.
What makes a world-class city? Is it just having winning sports teams, good shopping centers, and iconic skyscrapers? Or should having progressive practices that promote sustainability count among the world-class city criteria? One Atlanta resident, Matthew Garbett, thinks that the energy expended on cultivating tourist attractions and building sports arenas would be better spent creating walkable neighborhoods and slow growth that support community connection and sustainability. Among Garbett's list of grievances is the abundance of parking lots that prevent neighborhoods from becoming vibrant. And speaking of parking lots, my second guest today is Donald Shoup, an urban planner who has famously suggested that free parking actually brings tremendous costs to a city. Matthew Garbett and my 2010 discussion with Donald Shoup on this week's Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Matthew Garbett. He is a neighborhood activist in Atlanta, Georgia. Matt, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
First, I'd like you to talk about this piece that you recently just penned for Creative Loafing in Atlanta, entitled "Atlanta's Not a World-Class City." I'm sure you got a lot of pushback from locals there. I posted it on Facebook, and one of my friends had said, well, maybe he needs to move to Europe. What's the basic thesis behind this piece, Atlanta's Not a World-Class City?
The basic thesis, really, it kind of starts off, if you're involved in a lot of stuff in Atlanta, you'll find that Atlanta's really a big booster city. We have a lot, boosterism is a rampant disease here. And so friends of mine and I had been complaining about the boosterism for a while, and I kind of posted a rant on Facebook because we have a new football stadium that's opening up soon, and we keep hearing how it's world class. And the amazing thing about it is this world class stadium is required a couple hundred year old churches that had been in the community for obviously a century to get torn down. It's separating the communities physically by disrupting traffic and realigning streets. And it kind of grew out of there in the idea that we are placing our emphasis on becoming a better city by creating what we constantly call these world-class projects. So the stadium's the best example, and probably the one that most people around the country may be familiar with. But it seems like anytime there's a block of development, whether it's for a new museum or getting the College Football Hall of Fame, or you know the aquarium we got a few years ago, that this is the next world-class addition to the city that's going to make us a world-class city. And the thesis was basically that we're not going to become a world-class city by a bunch of isolated projects that are grand in scale but disconnected from their surrounding community. You can dot the landscape with quote-unquote iconic and world-class projects, but if they're not integrated into the city life and they're not making a more vibrant and walkable neighborhood, a museum with a parking deck and the customers go straight into doesn't do much for us. So that was kind of the thesis. And I think a lot of people kind of took it like your friend did of, oh, well, just get out of Atlanta if you don't like it. And that's not the case. I love Atlanta. I think we have great strides happening, but that we just need to get out of this large scale mentality and move towards a much larger focus on neighborhood building. And when we do build iconic projects, you know, make sure that they are part of the neighborhood, not part of a quote-unquote world-class attraction.
Yes, you write in the piece, I'll just quote it here, it says, "At some time, someone gave us a world-class city mug. It felt good, like when your kid gives you a world's best dad mug. I hate to say this, but that mug doesn't really make you the world's best dad, and repeating it at the most recent groundbreaking won't make it so." So I think that's not a problem unique to Atlanta. I think a lot of cities like to pat themselves on the back. Did you think this kind of construction fever sprang from hosting the 1996 Olympics, or was it before that?
You know, I think that a lot of people, you're going to get different answers, but I think yes. I think that a lot of the people I've talked to really felt like Atlanta, it's always been a booster business city, and you know, you look at the international airport and things like that, but that's actually an infrastructure and investment. But yes, after the 96 Olympics, the mentality became, oh, we just got this mug, let's do it. And so one of the lines I left out of the article is like, it's like taking your kids to Disney World every year, but not helping them with their homework. And so that kind of became the mentality of, oh God, we're on this international stage now. How do we do that without really looking to how other international cities have become the kind of walkable, sustainable places that they are. So I think the Olympics definitely had a big impact on that.
Let's talk about the Disney World versus homework analogy, if we can. What is some of the homework that urban planners, politicians, and activists like yourself should be embarking on to try to transform Atlanta into what could be universally construed as a world-class city?
I think part of it, and I think that this is probably one of the more nuanced ones, and I don't have the answer to, is that Atlanta has to continue to recognize its role as central to the metropolitan region. There's no escaping that we are a regional city, both by population and by area and sprawl. And Atlanta can't ignore that. But at the same time, Atlanta has to, as a city and as city leaders, has to kind of focus on our development pattern serving the residents and creating a healthier city. And I think that tension is going to come up, and what we, one of the most important things that I'm working on is the glut of parking in this city. You know, we talk about sprawl and we think that, oh, it's because the suburbs have moved out. But, you know, urban sprawl, limited, confined to a city, is a very real thing too. And if every store and every shopping center has this massive parking lot that expands even what we can walk to or bike to in the city limits, we have a problem. So we need to start reducing that glut of parking and focusing on, again, the small shop. It's ironic. Most of the city has been disinvested for the last 40 years, and that's been very difficult. But one of the good things about it is that you actually still have these core, you know, what planners call good bones neighborhoods with this lovely line of, you know, the old brick storefronts. And so we can refocus on those. But what people will then start to say is, you know, we also have to have all this parking in the central business district in downtown Buckhead and Midtown so that all these commuters can drive in. And so in our peripheral neighborhoods, we've kind of destroyed a lot of what we have through parking for residents. And then in our core business district, we've kind of destroyed a lot of what we have by making it incredibly easy for commuters to come in. And I always say, you know, if the counties that keep voting against having MARTA expand them, if we raised parking from a very low $14 a day to $30 a day, you would see commuter rail out to the surrounding counties the next year. So that's one of the biggest things that we need to do is to kind of get rid of the parking. In Atlanta, too, we're getting better at it, and we're supposed to be doing rezoning soon. But mixed use is still not allowed in a lot of our neighborhoods. So even some of these great core, good bones districts that I would call the old type, you know, walk-up downtowns or core of a neighborhood, might not even be able to put a store there anymore because, A, there's going to be a parking requirement. There's no parking. And, B, your bar can't be within 200 yards of a school, and there's the school down the street, and you can't have the place serving wine or coffee, and so we have to start looking at walkability as our primary emphasis at the neighborhood level to kind of create that strength and that sustainable city. And then by doing that, I think that, I hate to use the word competing, right now we're kind of in a middle zone where we're not really competing with the suburbs for residents because they want a certain lifestyle. We're not really competing with the other cities like San Francisco or Washington, D.C., or even, you hear about Des Moines or Minneapolis, which is doing phenomenal stuff right now. And so we need to kind of, I hate to say competing, but we need to kind of have an identity as a city of what we are to draw people to us. And I think that will come out through our own expression of our neighborhoods.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Atlanta neighborhood activist Matthew Garbett. The question is if it's too late for a city like Atlanta that's spread out, that's invested so much in these non-infrastructure projects. All right, so you write, Atlanta is not in the same league as New York, London, Paris, or others. When someone wins the lottery, Atlanta is not on his or her bucket list. Other American cities such as New York, Chicago, and San Francisco surely leave us behind. We are competing with Charlotte, Nashville, or Dallas. Is it better to maybe focus on these little parts of the suburbs and make these suburbs the walking areas and not focus on trying to get people into the downtown area and then have them walk?
I mean, I think that within the suburbs, obviously I would encourage any of the suburbs to try to create healthy, vibrant downtowns that they have and to try to rethink of themselves not as suburban cities, but as, as smaller cities. Local Georgia Tech professor Elena Dunham Jones wrote Retrofitting Suburbia, and I think that that's an excellent start for them. I do think in Atlanta, the downtown is our core. It is the key to our success, and Jeff Speck's Walkable City, which I think probably a lot of people interested in planning have read, revitalizing your downtown is one of the key components. And you have in our downtown, you have seen a resurgence in the last several years, decades. I mean, it's a neighborhood full of people that care about downtown. I mean, people think about it as sparse, but there's 30,000 people that live in a fairly small area in downtown who are working very hard. And one of the things I mentioned in the article that I think is a really great sign for the direction of Atlanta's downtown is, we have these world-class museums opening up. Nobody really cares. But what we also have opening up is a Walgreens, which will have, there'll be now a grocery store that with, a general-purpose Walgreens that people can walk to and get their needs and the daily needs without having to worry about, walking into a convenience store, walking a fairly long distance to a grocery store.
When I lived in Atlanta, sorry to interrupt, but when I lived in Atlanta in the 80s, the downtown was more like a financial district only, and so it closed on the weekend. You weren't going to find a Walgreens or something.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, Atlanta, yeah, we've really, the improvements in downtown have been really great, and downtown still does have a lot of the, so one of the best streets in the city, Broad Street, is downtown, and it's a street that's kind of closed off to traffic for the most part during the day, and it's a bunch of independent restaurants and business workers and Georgia State students are there. So I mean, Georgia State has grown tremendously since the 80s. So we now have a university downtown that has, I want to say, 30,000 students, and they're trying to get more of them to live on campus. So you've got an influx of 18 to 22 year olds. You've got people living in the apartments. there's a long way to go, but downtown's making really great progress if we can quit screwing up with worrying about these giant projects. And at the same time, you know, the healthier the neighborhoods around that become, the better it is too. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think we are making progress in a lot of ways. We're making baby steps. We just need to make the right baby steps.
Atlanta neighborhood activist Matthew Garbett. Matt, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Next, we're going to listen to my 2010 discussion with UCLA urban planning professor Donald Shoup. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Donald Shoup. He's the author of The High Cost of Free Parking and a professor at UCLA in urban planning. Professor Shoup, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you introduce our listeners first to your general thesis behind the high cost of free parking?
Well, American motorists park free at the end of 99% of their vehicle trips. Usually it doesn't seem that way to us when we're visiting a downtown area, but so many trips in the suburbs end up at a mall or a shopping center or a grocery store with free parking that we're used to free parking at most of our trips, either on street or off street. But just because the motorist doesn't pay for parking doesn't mean that the cost goes away. You know, the cost is really paid by everybody, even people who are too poor to own a car. The cost of parking gets included in the cost of restaurant meals or movie tickets or stuff you buy in the store. So with every transaction you make, a little bit of the money gets siphoned off to pay for parking. And that's how we get to park free at the end of our vehicle trips. So the parking is free to us only in our role as a driver, but we pay for parking in every other role we have in society, as a taxpayer, as an employer, as an employee, as a shopper, a diner. In every other role in life that we have, we pay for parking.
And free parking is really part of American lore in many ways, it seems, isn't it, Professor?
Well, everybody likes to park free, including me. But that doesn't mean we should elevate it to a public policy and say that everybody ought to park free. We have free parking and expensive housing. I think we have our priorities the wrong way around. And although parking seems a small element in our lives, let me try to put it into context that every day American motor vehicles by themselves consume 1/8 of the world's oil production. And 2/3 of this is imported, and we're paying for it with borrowed money. So I don't think this is really sustainable. And it isn't just that we're spending a lot of money overseas to buy oil for our cars so we can drive free to shopping centers to buy goods that are imported from China. There are other problems as well. I think that free parking almost everywhere makes driving the obvious way to travel. We may curse traffic and breathe exhaust and stare at taillights as we're going to where we're going, but we'll park free when we get there. And that free parking certainly encourages us to drive alone. I think that federal statistics show that 87% of all our trips in the United States are made by motor vehicle. And I mean, it'd be hard to get that any higher unless we eliminated walking.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to UCLA urban planning professor and the author of The High Cost of Free Parking, Donald Shoup.
You say at one point in your book, The High Cost of Free Parking, that parking is the unstudied link between transportation and land use. And obviously, you've dedicated your career largely to understanding parking in a more profound way than most municipalities. What's the impact of all this free parking on most municipalities?
Well, parking is both a transportation element and it's a big land use. That it's parking is the single biggest land use in any city. That there's more space devoted to parking than there is to housing or to offices or to factories or anything else. And one reason for this is that almost every city has an elaborate set of minimum parking requirements for every land use. If you want to build a movie theater, you might have to have 6 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet. Or if you want to have a restaurant, you have to have 20 spaces per 1,000 square feet. And really, you can't build or open any restaurant unless you have the required parking. And all of this required parking spreads everything out. It makes walking less pleasant because you're walking past large parking lots. It makes it very difficult to cluster a lot of activities in the kind of areas that everybody likes to walk around in. So I think it's the minimum parking requirements in cities' zoning laws that have made America look the way it does, which is a paradise for cars, but it's got problems for people.
About the restaurants, I read in your book that, I forget the exact ratio, but I think it's 4 times the amount of space, or is it 3 times the amount of land is required for, in many cities, for a restaurant to set up for their patrons parking?
Well, it depends on the city. Some cities have, in their downtowns, like in downtown San Francisco, have no parking requirement for restaurants. Therefore, you have lots of them. Other cities would require even 20 spaces per 1,000 square feet. So the parking lot at a restaurant is typically 3 times bigger than the restaurant itself.
Now that was stunning to me when you don't even think about that. You just go into the parking lot, you park, and you sit down, you eat your meal, but you forget that most of the space of this property owner or leaser is being taken up by the car you just parked.
Well, that's right. Often only a quarter of the site goes for the restaurant and 3/4 of the site goes for parking. And often the parking is empty. It makes it difficult to open up a restaurant, and especially to convert a vacant store into a restaurant. For example, if you have a building used as a shoe store that requires 2 spaces per 1,000 square feet and that goes out of business, and you want to reopen as a restaurant that requires 20 spaces per 1,000 square feet, the city will say, no, where's your required parking? So these minimum parking requirements prevent buildings from being used in the way that most people really want to see them used, such as, restaurants is a very popular attraction. Whenever cities do reduce or remove the parking requirements for restaurants, often there's an explosion of restaurants as the buildings are restored and reopened as restaurants, but only if you could do it without the required parking.
So do you think our priorities are misaligned when it comes to owning a vehicle then?
I don't want to pay for parking, and neither does anybody else, but you don't want to pay for gasoline, and you don't want to pay for insurance, and you don't want to pay for anything, really.
Right.
The parking is the big exception. It's very expensive, and we expect to get it for free. Say, for a new parking space at UCLA, we have 25,000 parking spaces on campus. The most recent ones are costing $30,000 a space. Now, how many of our students have $30,000 to their names? How many people in the United States have a net worth of greater than $30,000? That especially low-income people, their assets are less than $30,000, and yet we want to arrange our world so that everybody can have a $30,000 parking space so they can drive and park their, you know, $3,000 car for free. I think it's twisted our lives out of shape.
I found this quote in your book about cruising. Cruising is individually rational because it saves the driver some money for parking, but is collectively irrational because it takes time, congests traffic, wastes fuel, and pollutes the air. Now, it seems to me that statement captures a basic truth that applies to multiple realms of the environmental-ish movement and the push to more sustainable practices.
Yes, I think that if you want to improve the environment, it seems odd, but a good way to begin is to start with parking. Let me say that again. If you want to improve the environment, the best way to start is to reform parking policies. That one of the things that I do recommend is that cities should charge the right price for curb parking. And by right price, I mean the price at the meter that would lead to about 85% occupancy most of the time. Now, that 85% occupancy means that the space will be well used, that they'll be almost full, but the 15% vacancy rate is key. It means that anybody who comes to a block sees one or two vacant spaces there, and they won't have to drive around hunting for a space. That wherever you go, you'll see one or two vacant spaces on every block if you get the price right. San Francisco is embarking on this policy. Other cities have adopted it as well. That means the price may be 50 cents an hour, you know, in the early morning. It might be 75 cents an hour till noon. It might be $2 an hour from noon to 4 p.m. and 50 cents an hour from 9 p.m. to midnight or something like that. The price would vary throughout the day, but the reason it varies is to keep about 15% of the spaces vacant. There wouldn't be any driving around hunting for parking. And we did do studies of how much traffic is driving around. And in one little business district in Los Angeles, about 15 blocks, there's almost a million miles of travel a year, vehicle travel a year, hunting for underpriced curb parking. And that's travel that people don't want to make. It's driving that people don't want to do. The measurements were in one 15-block area of Los Angeles, but other studies have been done all over the world and found similar results.
This 15-block area is a million miles a year of cruising for parking?
That's right.
That's astounding. Well, we usually don't think of parking as part of the green movement, but you're opening a lot of eyes, Professor Shupin. We really thank you for the work you're doing and for taking the time to walk us through it today on Sea Change Radio.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Budos Band, Jimmy Reed, and Jimi Hendrix.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com.
That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.